people who don't know, and I don't see how you should not know. If you're a listener here to this radio station, you know that we are in fundraising mode right now, which means we are appealing to the listening audience right now, for those who have the means of doing it, to please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 516-620-3602. Or go to give to WBAI.org online. You will be glad you did, and you'll have the self-satisfaction saying that I am the solution to our financial situation here, okay? And also, let's not forget, of course, 7 p.m., we go out to our windows to clap for those individuals out there who are identified as essential workers. Okay, it's 6 p.m. Stay tuned for the WBAI Evening News coming up. Stay tuned.
Good evening. Thousands take to the streets of Minneapolis to protest the death of George Floyd by police officers. The mayor calls for the arrest of the cops who've been fired. The passing of a gay icon. We remember Larry Kramer. And his summer release from New York's jails. More are arrested. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. And President Donald Trump on Wednesday threatened to strongly regulate or even shut down social media platforms after Twitter applied a fact check to two of his tweets this week. Trump did not elaborate on what actions he could take. It's Trump's strongest threat to use his power to target the president's perceived political enemies among the tech giants. Trump's response came after Twitter began tagging his tweets, claiming mail-in balloting is susceptible to fraud as fake news over the weekend. It was the first time Trump's credibility was challenged by the social media platforms that have been important to mobilizing Trump's political base. Trump has also been sending baseless tweets about the 2001 accidental death of an aide to Trump critic and talk show host Joe Scarborough, claiming she was murdered. The woman, then 28-year-old Lori Klausoutis, was believed to have a heart problem when she collapsed and hit her head. Her husband has repeatedly asked Twitter to remove the president's support of the conspiracy theory. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the State Department no longer considered Hong Kong to have significant autonomy under Chinese rule. Hong Kong, a former British colony, has been aligned with China since 1997. China was supposed to guarantee the city autonomy for 50 years. Beijing has announced a new security law going over the head of the local government that would end the system known as One State, Two Systems. The move sparked massive protests, but Hong Kong residents are beginning to see the handwriting on the wall. China will soon be in charge. Amy, who supports the protests like many of the enclave's youth, says the law would be the end of Hong Kong's autonomy.
It definitely has a big impress if they actually passed that national security law. It means that it would be the end of the one country, two system policy, which was guaranteed to us when Hong Kong was returned to China. It will affect the daily life of Hong Kong people, definitely. If you know how people live in China, then you will know how unwillingly we want to live like that. For example, we won't even be able to go on Facebook or using Google. As you know, people can't use Google in China, or a lot of apps, even Messenger, WhatsApp, that we won't be able to use it.
Do you think that the protests will have an effect?
I don't think the protests will help. We're actually trying to get help from foreign governments, giving the PRC some pressure. They were saying that they're actually considering giving Hong Kong residents who were born before 1997 a refugee status so that they can live in the UK, which is a big deal, actually.
Would people leave Hong Kong?
People actually, with a little money, are already thinking about leaving. Young people, especially, if they don't have much money, they are thinking about moving to Taiwan, especially those who participated in the protest, they already escaped and went to Taiwan.
As a young person from Hong Kong, how do young people feel there?
Being very frustrated, angry, and sad. They feel like there's no way, no future. That's what they've been thinking. A lot of people are just, like my friend, she was crying for like one day after we heard the news. And it's just like since the past year, everything has changed a lot, especially the brutality of police. And there's basically no law in Hong Kong. The police are actually, basically they're doing everything and anything. And they can pass even basically a lot of things that they can get away from.
Is it dangerous to live there if you don't agree with this whole idea of getting rid of the two systems, one country rule?
Definitely, definitely. I think it was 1 month ago or 2 months ago, the police force went up to Facebook of division in Hong Kong and wanted to check people's profiles and saying that somebody who liked a page of this politician would definitely go to jail. That's what they were saying.
So you could go to jail for just liking the wrong Facebook page.
Exactly. That's what they were threatening us.
Being part of China, I mean, some people would say that's a good thing.
Being able to eat good things, wear good clothes, like pretty clothing, doesn't mean that you are having a good life.
Amy is a citizen of Hong Kong. She currently lives in New York City. If the security law passes, the Trump administration could impose the same tariffs on exports from Hong Kong that it puts on goods from mainland China. And in the United States, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey called on prosecutors to file criminal charges against a white police officer caught in a video using his knee to crush the neck of a black man on Monday. The officer, along with three others, were involved in the apprehension of 46-year-old George Floyd and were fired on Tuesday. The video, which has raised a national outcry, shows Floyd gasping for air and groaning, "I can't breathe," while bystanders beg the cop to let him up. Why is the man who killed George Floyd not in jail? If you had done it or I had done it, we would be behind bars right now, Frey said during a news briefing. The city identified the four officers on Wednesday as Derek Chauvin, Thomas Lane, Tao Thao, and J. Alexander Kung, but provided no detailed information. The case is reminiscent of the 2014 killing of Eric Garner, an unarmed black man in New York City who died after being put in a police chokehold and telling the officers, "I can't breathe." The officer who placed Garner in a fatal chokehold was fired, but not criminally prosecuted. Last night, thousands of Minnesotans gathered at the site of the killing in protest that began nonviolently but became violent as police car windows were smashed. Cops responded with tear gas grenades.
I'm with WCCO. Get out of here!
Protesters ripped down a chain-link fence at a police parking lot, some using skateboards to smash police car windows. Others coughed and spit as clouds of tear gas enveloped them and used milk to wash their eyes of the caustic gas. At one point, they chanted, "I can't breathe," at a phalanx of police. George Floyd lived in St. Louis Park, a Minneapolis suburb. He grew up in Houston. He was a well-liked high school football player, once scoring a dramatic touchdown. His friends and employers say that they had nothing bad to say about him. They say he never caused a fight or was rude to people. In a video he posted after a friend was killed violently, Floyd urged young people to give up gunplay.
"Our young generation is clearly lost, man. Clearly lost, man. Like. I don't even know what to say no more, man. Like, you youngsters just going around, just busting guns in crowds, kids getting killed, you know, and it's clearly the generation after us, man, that's so lost, man. Come on home, man. One day it's going to be you and God. You're going up or you're going down. You know what I'm saying?"
And that's George Floyd speaking before his death, of course. There is already growing controversy over the two police reports about the incident. In one, the police said Floyd was suffering medical distress. And another, called by police, an updated statement announced the FBI was joining the investigation. An attorney for the family is Benjamin Crump. He says it was murder.
There is new surveillance video from a restaurant that shows you George Floyd's demeanor. And you look at that video for yourself. It doesn't seem like he was posing a threat to these police officers, and they did not have to use this lethal, excessive force for somebody who they was investigating for a nonviolent forgery charge. I mean, we are seeing I Can't Breathe Again in 2020. And it's so much worse because, Don, it's not 1 minute, it's not 2 minutes, it's not 3 minutes, it's not 4 minutes, it's not 5 minutes, it's not 6 minutes, it's not 7 minutes, it's not 8 minutes. It is over 9 minutes. They have a man begging for his life with a knee of a police officer on his neck, and nobody offers him any humanity. I would ask that people take a stopwatch and put it for 9 minutes and just try to imagine George Floyd struggling for breath, struggling for life. How is this not murder?
Benjamin Crump is a lawyer for the family of George Floyd. This morning, Texas Democratic Representative Al Green gave an impassioned speech on the House floor.
I rise to say, Mr. Speaker, that black lives do not matter as much as white lives. If black lives matter as much as white lives, Mr. George Floyd will still be breathing. If black lives matter as much as white lives, Ahmaud Arbery would have finished his job, his jog. If black lives matter as much as white lives, Christian Cooper wouldn't have been falsely accused. Black lives do not matter as much as white lives. Why? Because we tolerate hatred, bigotry, and invidious discrimination. We tolerate it, and because we tolerate it, we allow it to be perpetuated. We in this country have the power to do something about the racism that exists as it relates to black people. We have tolerated it since 1619 and the arrival of black people in the Americas. But it's time for us to do something about it. We've had the opportunity to do something when the chief executive officer of this country is a racist and a bigot. We should do something about that. And we had the opportunity to, but we did not. We tolerated it. And there were some who went so far as to almost justify it with some of their commentary about the comments that were being made. Oh, he's just a jerk. Black lives matter, and we ought not tolerate it to the extent that we have. I believe that we in the Congress of the United States of America have a duty to do what has been done in the past. We declared a war on poverty. We declared a war on drugs. Why not declare a war on racism? Why not decide that here and now we are not going to allow racism to continue in this country to the extent that people lose their lives? What happened to some of the persons who've lost their lives as of late is almost predictable, because we have seen circumstances similar occur and we have not taken aggressive action. The officers in the Floyd case should not only be arrested, they ought to be prosecuted. I was a magistrate. I know probable cause when I see it, and there is probable cause to arrest and prosecute those officers. Black lives matter. And those who have not allowed the Black Lives Matter movement to continue to become the movement that can make a difference in the lives of people in this country, you have some responsibility, because you fought the very movement that was going to make a difference in the lives of people, may have saved some lives of people. So I rise today, Mr. Speaker, to say that we in Congress have some responsibility to the people we serve. And a part of that responsibility is to assure them that they can go jogging and return home, that if they are arrested by the police, they won't be suffocated to the extent that they lose their lives. We have to make sure that we tell this country in no uncertain terms that black lives do matter. And finally, this. It's not about Democrats and not about Republicans. I'm not blaming the Republicans for what's happening. I'm not blaming the Democrats for what's happening. I'm blaming people who hold public trust and tolerate hate and invidious discrimination. We are the people who can make a difference, and we ought to make a difference. We ought to demand that the people running for public office make public statements about how they plan to end invidious discrimination, not how they plan to tolerate it, how they plan to manage it. How do you plan to end it? How do you plan to end it in banking? How do you plan to end it in hiring and promotions? This is our time. If we don't do it now, when will we do it? No candidate should be off limits. Every one of them ought to have to tell us what they plan to do. And finally, in my final comments, I love my country. And because I love my country, I feel that I have this duty, obligation, and responsibility to speak up when these kinds of injustices occur.
That's Texas Democrat Al Green today on the House floor. And California Democrat Senator Kamala Harris, a former prosecutor and candidate for president, says the killing was a public execution.
That caused that man to die needlessly at the knee of someone who was using force that was unnecessary and was clearly not only in violation of the civil rights of that community and that man, but was, you know, torture in the way that it was done. The man couldn't breathe. He was begging. He was begging to be able to breathe. And he was executed. It was a public execution.
Senator Kamala Harris. Among the business in Congress today were hearings on the impact of the coronavirus on minorities, reauthorization of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and plans for legislation to bring high-speed internet access to poor communities, closing the digital divide. But during her news conference, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Majority Whip James Clyburn had this to say about the Floyd killing.
So just it breaks your heart. It just breaks your heart. It's so sad. But there has to be liberty. There has to be justice there. Mr. Clyburn, may I yield to you on this?
Justice is really at a threat in this country. And Rubio talked in his article about how if we do not do this, he sees real calamity in the not-too-distant future for our country. I've been seeing it for some time now, and that's why I've been silent this morning, because I go out there, I talk to people, I stop on the street corners. When I walk up down these hallways, I nod at the speaker and to Frank, but I spend time with the people who are scrubbing the floors and moving the furniture. I talk to them about their children. I talk to them about what their experiences, and I can tell you, we have got to do something to restructure things.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Majority Whip James Clyburn. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. And in New York, the founder of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, Larry Kramer, a playwright and film producer who lived with AIDS since 1988, died of pneumonia today at the age of 84. His outspoken and confrontational tactics made ACT UP a powerhouse that battled presidents and health officials to make AIDS research a priority and find a cure for the disease that affected people from many backgrounds, but first emerged in the gay community. WBAI producer David Rothenberg was a good friend. He says Larry Kramer was one of a kind.
Well, of course, Larry in public was ferocious and in private was a pussycat. I just got the news when you called, Paul, just a call a moment ago. And I haven't really reflected on it, but Larry was a longtime friend. And he was really a very kind and gentle man. When he got up in public, he was angry. And he had certainly during the AIDS epidemic, which is when he gained his reputation. Before that, he was an accomplished writer and Oscar nominee for a screenplay. But he, I guess, oppressed people. In this case, a gay man who, if you know his story, he went. He was in college, and they sent him to therapy to be cured. And oppressed people can get very angry if it's internalized so long. And so when he finally had a public forum, he went into a rage, accusatory of people's indifference in the early days of the AIDS epidemic. But that's not who he was. He was a thoughtful, kind, decent, gentle human being in direct contrast to the ferocious man that the public saw. I don't know if you can understand that contradiction, but when, but I think all groups, African-Americans, Hispanic, women, any group that's, it's, I guess you call it what Philo Kennedy used to call the pathology of the oppressed, that part of the rage comes out when dealing with, in the, when you go into the public arena. So Larry was a paradox, but I remember him, quiet dinners, having serious discussions, and a lot of laughter. So it's difficult to assemble it all right now in my mind, just having gotten the news that he passed away.
Any stories about him off the top of your head you would remember, something that would be...
Well, it's a terrible story. It was a memorial service for one of our mutual friends, and he pointed at us all in the audience and said, "You, because of the man who died of AIDS," and you know, the campaign of was silence equals death, and he screamed at us all, "You killed him." And afterwards, Larry said to me, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to report myself to the police department for murder." And we laughed about that. We cried about the loss of a dear friend who was Vito Russo, who had been a filmmaker. And we laughed about the fact that we could laugh amidst the tears. So, but he was effective. I used to tell him, when there was a political meeting and he wasn't invited, I said, "We're like Army football team in the 40s, Mr. Outside, Mr. Inside. You're Mr. Outside. You scream and yell, and therefore the mayors and the city council people aren't going to invite you to the inside, but you've made it possible for the others to get on the inside. So it's, if it's not about each of us, it's about getting the things done, then play your role and you do it effectively." And he understood that, but he still wanted to be on the, he wanted to be outside and inside. But you can't call Ed Koch a murderer when he was mayor and then expect him to be invited to a strategy meeting on how to deal with AIDS.
How about his activism?
ACT UP protests were original, dramatic, theatrical. He brought his dramatic skills into the political arena. He was very effective. It's what Al Sharpton has done so effectively, is to use your theatrical instincts to make a point, because, you know, the quiet conversations don't make the 6 o'clock news. The dramatic ones do. Mm-hmm. And so your role is, you're not, you may not get to sit down at the table. You're not, you may not be, what's the song from Hamilton? Four voices in a room. What was it? Whatever that song was. Well, they used to say in Albany, three men in a room. That's what it was. Yeah. But Larry used it, his sense of theater, to mobilize dissidents and to alert the public. It was a real role.
What's going to be his legacy?
ACT UP is his legacy. He aroused a generation of gay people to find their voice.
David Rothenberg. He's a producer here at WBAI, longtime friend of Larry Kramer. Kramer was also a founder of Gay Men's Health Crisis, a group he was kicked out of for his aggressive style before founding ACT UP. In 1988, Kramer called director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, a killer and an incompetent idiot for his reaction to HIV. The two later became friends. Fauci now heads up the president's coronavirus task force, where he often battles President Trump over the government's response to the disease. And on March 27th, the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Corrections announced that it would release 1,100 people jailed in county lockups for accusations of technical parole violations. It was a move to stop the spread of COVID-19. But 2 months since the announcement, Columbia Justice Lab has produced a report concluding fewer than 800 people were released. Over these same 2 months, the report projected that more than 150 new people accused of technical parole violations were sent to the Rikers Island jail. Vinny Schiraldi of Columbia Justice Lab says the slow movement is a result of a lingering mass incarceration mentality.
very disappointing. First of all, Department of Corrections said they'd be able to release 1,100 people locked up pre-trial, pre-hearing on technical violations, you know, running, you know, missing appointments or staying out past curfew, things like that, who are on state parole. Not new crimes, but misbehavior, if you will. They didn't hit that mark. They got about three-quarters of the way there. 790 releases, 300 out of the 400 they expected to release from Rikers. And then they started violating new people and locking them up for missing appointments and staying out past curfew. So there's another 170 of them have come back in to Rikers, not for new crimes, during the pandemic.
Why are they holding on to violating people on small things? I mean, what's the purpose of that, really?
The old bad habits of mass incarceration are dying slowly. This is not atypical of prison systems around the country that have just not really responded to the emergency as if it's an emergency and are still packing medically vulnerable people into the opposite of social distancing, forced congregation in unhygienic prisons around the country. New York has done better in a lot of respects with regards to handling of the pandemic, but not in terms of prisons.
What is the actual problem in the prisons with the COVID-19?
Rikers Island, which is where you go before you go to state prison. If you're being accused of a technical violation, you go there and you wait for your hearings. We got 1,500 staff and almost 400 incarcerated people have tested positive. Three incarcerated people have died, but the first two people, Michael Tyson and Raymond Rivera, died locked up for a technical violation, for missing appointments and failing a drug program. So it's very real. 13 staff have died. The head doctor at Rikers called it a storm. People shouldn't be there for lots of reasons, but people in for not committing a new crime, it's just madness.
How do they decide who gets let out?
They excluded people with mental health issues, which is just, it's unfathomable. I know they were looking for housing for people. So it's a bit of corrections practice that's always done behind closed doors, and I think this includes that.
If they don't have a home to go or a family to go back to when they're released, what do they do?
New York City actually paid for hotel space for people being released, and they included state technical parole violators in that. So even though that's not specifically people under New York City's control, they made the hotels available so they wouldn't be packed into Rikers.
What are you going to do about this? What's next?
Today, there's a COVID set of hearings up in Albany where they're voting on bills, so my hope is that it could get inserted there. If it doesn't, what I'm hearing is they may come back after the primary to look at legislation. I mean, this was a bad idea before the pandemic to be locking up about 6,000 people at a cost of about $600 million a year. That was kind of stupid before. Now it's indefensibly stupid, both because we're going to put them in harm's way and spread the virus in and out of prisons and jails, but also because we could use the $600 million now.
To stop this action of picking people up on these small things, that it's refilling the prison even as they release people, would take a sea change in how they look at people who are incarcerated.
This is where I sort of feel for parole officers. We throw very difficult challenges at them. We give them insufficient resources, high caseloads, and we say, okay, now, you know, play God. Pick who gets locked up and who gets to go home. And I think that's bad. I think we should say, look, some stuff's too trivial to get locked up. And when you do get locked up, you should only get locked up for a short period of time on any kind of technical, and it should be only the most serious technical. I think the legislature and the governor need to step in and say that, and then give parole officers discretion within that, along with some resources like housing and employment and treatment to help folks so that when they come out of prison, they have a chance to thrive. And not just go in and out and in and out of our jails and prisons.
Vinny Schiraldi of Columbia's Justice Lab. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. A personal note, I will be on assignment starting tomorrow, but I will return on June 9th. Thanks for listening to WBAI. Please be generous in your support of this unique voice in New York City.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions